Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking questions live on air, by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate that you have a question, you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will be placed in the queue to be on air. Also, feel free to log into our chat room and pose questions there. Sexual violence generally is not something we're comfortable talking about in this country, and we have a long way to go to stop its occurrence and respond in a survivor-centric manner. When it comes to rape and sexual assault on those who have lost their liberties, the challenge is far greater. There are public misconceptions about sexual violence in prisons and jails. Many people have a throw-the-key-away attitude, and there's a lack of understanding about the long-term impact of such violence to the overall safety and well-being of our communities. Passed in 2003, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, called PREA, is the first federal civil statute focused solely on addressing sexual violence in juvenile facilities, jails, prisons, lockups, and other facilities. PREA established a national commission which held hearings about sexual misconduct in custody, issued reports on the problem of sexual victimization in secure facilities, and proposed standards for the prevention, detection, and response to sexual misconduct in criminal and juvenile justice settings. The problem of prison rape that PREA is attempting to remedy is nothing short of staggering. One report found that 1 in 10 adult inmates and more than 12% of kids being held in correctional settings were sexually abused while confined. But most experts believe that the actual rate of sexual violence is much higher. Historically, when a prisoner has come forward and reports of sexual assault, he or she frequently faces harassment, discipline, or further abuse. And solitary confinement is often used as a way to handle the situation. The PREA standards, which went into effect on August 20th of this year, seeks to redress these practices and more. Today's guests will be providing more background on PREA, the ensuing standards, and specifically focus on how they apply to facilities that house youth and what jurisdictions are starting to do to implement the standards. Our guests are Linda McFarland, who is the Deputy Executive Director of Just Detention International, called JDI. JDI is a health and human rights organization that seeks to end sexual abuse in all forms of detention. Linda has worked with survivors of sexual violence in a variety of settings throughout the last 2 decades, including training thousands of rape crisis counselors and correction staff members on how to respond to and prevent sexual violence in detention. She has worked to improve policies and practices in corrections departments that hold youth and adults and has provided support and advocacy to survivors across the United States. Linda formerly directed a community rape crisis counseling program and prior to that worked as a direct line staff member, unit supervisor, and then therapist at a groundbreaking secure treatment facility for mentally ill incarcerated teen girls. She's worked in crisis intervention with a variety of populations, including survivors of domestic violence and child abuse, teens and adults living with mental illness, and people living in poverty and with addictions. Dana Schoenberg is the Deputy Director of the Center for Children's Law and Policy, known as CCLP. CCLP is a public interest law and policy organization focused on reform of juvenile justice and other systems that affect troubled and at-risk children, and protection of the rights and children in those systems. Dana helps juvenile justice systems across the country reduce racial and ethnic disparities, increase alternatives to secure detention, and improve conditions of confinement in juvenile facilities. She is also active in the nation's capital promoting federal legislative and policy reforms related to juvenile justice. She previously served in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division Special Litigation Section, where she investigated and sought remedies for patterns and practices of constitutional and other federal law violations in state and local juvenile detention facilities, jails, prisons, and police departments. And she's also held two clinical teaching fellowships. She received a master's in legal advocacy from Georgetown University Law Center and her Juris Doctor from Yale Law School. So Linda and Dan, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thanks so much.
So I start off really speaking briefly about sexual violence in the corrections facilities, but can you provide more information about what was happening across the country that eventually led to the passage of PREA?
Sure, Lauren. I mean, I think that PREA, its existence, its passage, really is a result of a sea change that was occurring in the corrections world. As probably many of you listeners know, prior to in the 80s and the early 90s, really the only time you would hear about sexual violence in detention was in the manner of a joke or talking about a politician who would sort of deserve what he or she got once they got to jail or prison. And I think what started happening is more real-life cases of what was going on and what this abuse actually looked like were coming to light. Also, advocacy groups were working more and more with corrections groups, and some corrections officials were becoming concerned about the problem as well. One of, honestly, the landmark cases that I think really brought different kind of attention to the issue was a youth named Rondi Hulin, who was in an adult facility in Texas. And despite pleas for help about being repeatedly sexually abused, he didn't get them. And his mother attempted to help him, and he ended up actually committing suicide to escape the abuse. And that case really garnered a lot of national attention and led to a coalition of different advocacy groups. Just Detention International, formerly known at that time as Stop Prisoner Rape, began to do some more media work around it. And what happened was really kind of unlikely allies got together to look and say, no matter where you are in the political spectrum, most of us can agree that people who are incarcerated are in prison or jail or a youth facility, and they've lost their liberty as the punishment, that being sexually abused while they're there is never okay, and that we can't pay for our government institutions to allow people to be abused. So there was a lot of survivor activism, a lot of activism on the part of advocacy groups, and that led to, again, a bipartisan effort to pass the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and it was passed in 2003 by a unanimous Congress, and I'm sure, as everyone knows, that certainly doesn't happen very often. And as you mentioned, Lauren, once more research started being done, the statistics are fairly alarming with the numbers of youth, 1 in 8, as you mentioned, or 12%, who are in detention being abused, and the majority by staff. And I think looking at why it's so important, why PREA represents such an opportunity, that the youth detention system, juvenile justice system, really is about giving youth who don't, who a second chance, another chance, giving them tools, giving them care. And if a youth is then abused by the very people who are charged with giving them care, a second chance, tools that they haven't gotten yet so far, abuses them, then that second chance is kind of more than gone.
So PREA
accomplished a number of things, and as a main point, PREA was Congress's way of saying we expect that there will be a zero-tolerance standard for prison rape in all custodial facilities, and Congress said that systems really need to work at a number of different levels, at prevention of sexual misconduct in facilities, at detection, and at appropriate responses if it does happen. So Congress did a number of things in PREA to move that ball forward. It created the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission, and the commission was responsible to take testimony, have hearings around the country, write a report about its findings, and then make recommendations about specific standards that the government should expect locked facilities and other custodial facilities to comply with in order to detect and respond to and prevent sexual misconduct. And it also established new ways of finding data. So when Linda talks about the finding that 12% of youth were subjected to some kind of sexual abuse either from staff or from other youth in facilities, that's a study that happened because PREA said that the Bureau of Justice Statistics needs to collect more data about this problem.
There was a report that was published, correct?
Yes.
Based on that, just for people to know, it's called the Sexual Victimization in Juvenile Facilities Report, reported by youth.
Yes, and people can find a link to that on our website if they're having trouble finding it on the Justice Department's website. Then there was also some initial funding for and training opportunities established so that systems could begin to think about how to address the problems. And then an important piece of PREA is that it said that the Justice Department had to issue binding national standards and that states that receive various kinds of what they call prison funds, and those funds can be things like, in the juvenile justice context, the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act funds, burn grants, some of the other federal funding streams, that if they don't comply with the standards that the Justice Department issues, then they'll lose 5% of those funds. And then the final piece of that is that the Justice Department was expected to take the recommendations that the commission made and issue nationally binding standards that states would be subjected to loss of those funds if they didn't comply with them.
So I just want to step back for a moment. That was a great overview, and we do want to move into what are some of the standards and how they really pertain to youth and facilities. But the Bureau of Justice Statistics, as you said, went out and did some research, and that there were also hearings before the commission. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more about what the research found. What really are we looking at, and what was the state of affairs, especially for youth?
Sure. You know, but prior to PREA, and I think, you know, in a world and a society where there's many populations are really over-researched, I think prior to PREA there was really startlingly few studies on sexual abuse in detention facilities and almost very, very few on youth. And so as Dana mentioned, part of what the Prison Rape Elimination Act did was mandate that there be research, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics was tasked with that. And what they did is they went to surveyed over 9,000 youth in 195 juvenile confinement facilities across the country. And what was really different about these surveys is that they were anonymous surveys that were done by researchers, but on a computer program so that to make it as accessible as possible, basically. And youth received a guarantee of anonymity and a guarantee that their information that they provided couldn't really come back to them. And, of course, this was all in an effort to make it as safe as possible. And what they found, again, was that of those youth that they surveyed, asked anonymously, 12.1% said that they had experienced some kind of victimization. And most of that, the majority of that victimization was by staff, alarmingly. They found as well that the abuse was very often cross-gender, so that boys were abused by female staff, girls were abused by male staff. And that led to some really kind of interesting findings that I think a lot of people didn't expect, that, for example, the majority of abusers that the youth named were actually female staff, which, again, is, I think, not what people expected. Also, what was found is that youth who'd been victimized or abused had usually endured repeated sexual abuse. Many said more than 10 times, frequently by multiple perpetrators, so that the youth that are living with this and dealing with this are having to basically go through this type of abuse again and again, again in a place where they're supposed to be getting tools, getting help, preparing for life as adults, they're experiencing this kind of abuse. Many of the youth in the survey had been previously sexually abused, either in their life before or at another facility. And those youth who had been abused before were very, very likely to be sexually abused again. And another group that was really likely to be sexually abused in their current facility when the survey was going on were youth who were lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. And so one of the things I think that the research really did was, for the first time, give advocates and corrections a tool to examine what really is going on and what can we do about it. What are the strategies that are going to lead to not only youth being safer in the first place, but youth who need help being more likely to be able to get it?
Linda, we do have a question just on the stats about the rates for males and females. Was it similar across the board? A victimization for girls and boys?
Well, the study does break down the rates by facility, and people can access that. As Dana mentioned, it's available through Children's Center for Law and Policy's website. It's also available through Just Detention International's website and links. And so they did break it down. So what we're talking about is a national average. And yes, I mean, overall abuse by staff really did tend to be cross-gender. And most youth who are incarcerated are male. So that dynamic meant that female staff were the majority of abusers, but actually it was even disproportionately higher that boys were being abused by female staff than you would expect by just the breakdown of the population.
I was going to add a little bit more. So we do know that there's a little bit of difference between males and females in terms of the types of victimization. So male youth were more than twice as likely as female youth to be sexually abused by staff, while female youth were more than four times as likely as male youth to be sexually abused by another youth. So there was a little bit difference in terms of the kinds of abuse within a facility.
Okay. And in the beginning, you both mentioned sort of what the goal of the juvenile justice system is. And so I don't know, I think we may have not really talked about the impact of rape and sexual assault on youth in, you know, what is the long-term impact, that why should we care about this?
Teenagers, you know, youth, kids are obviously still going through developmental stages. And I think probably, you know, anyone who's ever worked with teenagers knows that. And we have more and more information about really developmentally the important tasks that youth still have to do well through their late teens in terms of brain development, in terms of social skills, in terms of understanding and dealing with, you know, kind of thinking ahead. And in terms of, frankly, peer pressure, it sounds cliched, but youth still have a lot of development that, you know, they are not adults. And what happens to a youth when they're traumatized during some of those developmental stages is that their development gets stopped. It gets interrupted, and it gets changed. So, for example, one obvious area is youth are developing their sexual identity, their gender identity. And if someone is sexually abused while their gender identity, their sexual identity is really still in sort of the developmental stages in flux, then that abuse really impacts how they feel about themselves, how they feel about sexuality, and how they move forward. It's similarly in terms of building confidence, you know, a teenager's job is to sort of take tentative steps in the world and see if they can manage it and then kind of retreat back to a safe place to check in and how did I do and regroup. And if in some of those tentative steps to be an adult, they are, you know, severely, they're abused and they're traumatized, particularly by people who are supposed to care for them, then those youth get messages that they actually can't make it, that the world is not a safe place. And it's really hard to get back that development if you don't get a chance to do it uninterrupted in the first place.
And then I think on top of that is the question of being in this correctional environment. And if you're experiencing that sort of trauma in a correctional environment, then, you know, there are all sorts of different responses that people have to trauma. But acting out, needing mental health care, working through the trauma in a variety of ways is sort of part of the natural response to those experiences. And those are things that can lead to really negative outcomes when you're inside a locked facility. It may mean that you experience discipline. You may have trouble getting access to the mental health care that you need or the representation that you need, or the basic support, victim support that you need. And all those things mean that your chances of making it out of the juvenile justice or the adult criminal justice system are diminished because you're having trouble coping and conforming to the expectations inside the, facilities, which tend to be places that have a lot of rules attached to them and things that you have to comply with.
Yeah.
So it really sends kids on a different trajectory, and we hear survivors talking about that, that after that experience, you know, their course was very different inside the facility and then afterwards as they got out.
As part of the fact-finding, I know that the National Commission also looked at what was happening to youth in adult prisons and jails. Were there different findings pertaining to that?
Yeah, so there are a number of them. You know, one of the first things that the commission recognized is that there's a thing called the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act. I mentioned it before. It's an act that has a number of requirements, and then in return, states can get federal funds that they can use for juvenile justice and delinquency prevention programs and services. And they have some core requirements that include that you have to sight and sound separate juveniles from adults if they're going to be in a locked facility, and they're also not supposed to be in a jail for more than a few hours as they're getting processed through. But those protections don't apply to adult-charged youth. So one of the most important things that the commission recognized was that youth who are charged as adults can be mixed with adults all the time. And are in a number of facilities, and that's a dangerous circumstance for them because they're young and vulnerable, because they may be mixed with adults who have a higher level of offending behaviors. And there are about 200,000 youth tried as adults every year, was the statistic that the commission found. It's probably higher now. That was a few years ago. Between 1990 and 2004, the commission recognized that there was a 208% increase in juveniles charged held in adult jails, and that on any day there were about 8,500 youth who were under 18 in adult jails and prisons. And they're probably the population, youth in adult jails and prisons, that are at the highest risk of victimization of any group that we're talking about. So they're about 1% of the jail population in 2005 were kids under 18. They represented 21% of the victims of substantiated inmate sexual violence. So that means that somebody investigated and found that it actually occurred. So they were 1% of the population, but 20% of the victims. And then the other thing that the commission recognized that was important was that the level of service that's available to youth who are charged in the adult system and housed in adult jails and prisons is just not the same as if they're in a juvenile facility. So they're not getting the same educational opportunities, family counseling, career development, or even just basic survival skills to keep themselves safe in an adult facility. And one of the most powerful statistics that I will never forget from the first time I read it, when Debra Bell, who's a terrific advocate for kids and adults who are incarcerated, she when she testified before the commission, she said that of all the kids who had been given life without parole sentences in the three states of Missouri, Illinois, and Michigan, who she was representing, there were about 420 of them. 80% of those people who were her clients reported that they had been sexually assaulted by another inmate in their first year of their life without parole sentence.
Linda, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
I mean, just again, thinking back to the impact of a trauma, of a sexual assault, that even more so that, you know, when you talk about youth who are in adult facilities, and particularly youth who've been traumatized, that there are not likely to be people around who understand adolescent development at all. You know, it's some, you know, many youth facilities have become, you know, pride themselves in really understanding adolescent development and developing programs that work around that and that deal with that and help provide an environment where youth can develop in a more healthy way, you know, despite the challenges in that. And then, in the, you know, when you have a youth in an adult facility, you're not going to have that at all. And when you have the impact of initial trauma, someone feeling overwhelmed, maybe having panic attacks, nightmares, having difficulty concentrating, having difficulty planning their day, having difficulty maintaining themselves in such a structured environment, in such an overwhelming environment when it comes to lack of privacy and noise and lights, that all of those things are really very triggering to someone who's been traumatized. And I the youth anecdotally that I have worked with who were people who were abused in adult facilities really found those initial stages to be completely untenable, that's a time when they received new charges, that's a time when they received disciplinary and often ended up in segregation because they weren't able to maintain on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think that really outlines quite well the overwhelming problem that we have. Mm-hmm. So let's turn to the standards now. Maybe you can just briefly say how they were developed, who had input into them, but then let's really look at what facilities are covered. So
in their development, the PREA created the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission, and as Dana mentioned, one of the tasks of the commission was to complete a final report and develop a set of standards. And so what the commission did was convene groups of experts. So they had people in a youth working group, medical and mental health working group, investigations working groups, so looking at all the different areas that the standards should cover in order to prevent, detect, and respond to sexual abuse. They pulled together expert committees who drafted first samples of what the standards could look like in those areas. And those expert committees were made up of advocates, corrections people, other criminal justice consultants. One of the things that Just Detention International was very pleased that we were able to do was we made sure that there were actually also survivors on those committees. pardon me. And the commission then sort of synthesized and put together standards. There were public comment periods then where people from across the spectrum who might have a stake in what the final standards look like contributed. They received tens of thousands of public comments on the first draft, and then used those comments to redraft, and finally submitted the final report in June of 2009, and then to the Department of Justice, the White House, Congress, and then what happened next was the Department of Justice went through a process to review it, to do an analysis of cost, to again get more feedback from people in corrections, and then issued a final set of standards this past June. What happens now is that federal facilities have to be in compliance with the standards immediately, and county, city, and state facilities have 1 year from August, so until August of 2013, to be in compliance with the standards.
So when it, as it pertains to youth, what facility do these standards apply to?
Okay. So just as a general matter, there are four different types of standards that the Justice Department has issued. So there's one set for jails and prisons, one set for juvenile facilities, one set for community corrections, and then I'm forgetting one. Linda, help me.
Lockups.
Oh, yeah. Police lockups is the fourth one. So there are these four separate sets of standards, and youth facilities are going to be parts of two of them. So there are youth in adult jails and prisons, And for those facilities, the adult jail and prison standards apply, but there are some special protections for youth. Then the facilities that are covered by the juvenile justice standards are facilities that are primarily used for the confinement of juveniles pursuant to the juvenile justice or criminal justice system. And a juvenile is any person under 18, unless they're under adult court supervision and confined or detained in a prison or jail. So what that means is that if there's a facility for adult charged youth that's run by a juvenile justice system, and there are systems in the country where kids are charged in the adult system, but they're actually housed in facilities that the juvenile justice systems run just for adult charged kids, those would be under the juvenile justice standards. A facility that's got a private contract, for example, with a state, it might have a combination of juvenile justice and mental health kids. And if it's primarily used, 51% basically, for juvenile justice kids, then they're covered by the standards. So, and then the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that the juvenile justice facilities, even though there's a separate set of standards for community confinement facilities, meaning places like group homes and residential treatment staff secure facilities, if they're juvenile group homes or juvenile staff secure residential treatment facilities, then the juvenile justice standards apply to them too.
Okay. And I also want to remind our listeners that they can ask questions in the chat room or they can call in and speak to our guests live on air by dialing 347-994-1149, and you will press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. So you both mentioned, though, that the standards cover all these different areas, so prevention, detection, response. Can you give some examples of these different areas, and what are they covering?
Sure. So as you mentioned, the standards really go much cover across really all kinds of managing a facility, all areas of it. Start with the prevention, and really the overarching theme of the standards is that facilities departments must have what they call the zero tolerance for sexual abuse and her sexual harassment. So in other words, one incident's too many, that everything that the facility or the department's doing to this end has to be towards the goal of eliminating sexual abuse in detention. As a kind of an interesting side note, when the law was very first drafted and was a bill, it was originally called the Prison Rape Reduction Act. And that didn't actually pass. And in the second round of drafting and talking about it, it was decided that was part of the problem, that one is too much, and so we can't have our end goal to be reduction. Our end goal has to be elimination, and that's really where the zero tolerance standards kind of sets the stage for the rest of the standards. Also in prevention is, as Dana mentioned, contracting. So if a department contracts with other entities to house youth, then they have to make sure that there's provisions in the contracts to make sure that they're not sending kids to facilities that aren't putting the same kind of protections in place. To look at how you supervise and monitor youth, we mentioned the statistic of the cross-gender abuse, so there's protections in the standards regarding viewing and searching youth by staff of a different gender from themselves. Looking at residents with disabilities and who might have limited English proficiency, making sure that they have the same protections, same access to information. I think another really key one is hiring and promotion decisions, that hoping that the days when someone could abuse a youth and still be promoted, still be hired at or transferred to a different facility, how do we make sure that actually doesn't happen? In terms of response, how do you respond to an actual incident, making sure that facilities know how to preserve evidence, how to make sure that someone who's been sexually abused recently receives a proper medical care, including a forensic examination to collect evidence, and making sure that every single allegation is referred for an investigation. Obviously, those things all lead to a need for training, staff training, that every staff member is trained, volunteers and contractors who are coming in are trained, people who are doing investigations or providing medical or mental health care have to receive additional specialized training, and that the youth, the residents of these facilities, have to receive comprehensive education that talks about their right to be free from sexual abuse, how to make reports, how to get help, what is sexual abuse, what do we mean by sexual abuse or sexual harassment. And that's really so important, because a facility, a department can make all the policy changes that they would like, but if the youth don't actually know what their rights are or how to use those policies, then it's not going to make the impact that it could.
Well, I think that's actually an important point for even all of our listeners, because I was using, you know, this larger term, sexual violence, which encompasses many different things. So what do we mean by sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and anything that would pertain to PREA?
Well, there's a wide range of conduct that can be included in those, and we've seen them in facilities. So there's everywhere from inappropriate viewing of someone in a state of undress, sexual harassment includes things like calling people really inappropriate sexualized names, or talking about what you want to do with them, or writing them letters. And we see a full continuum of problems from those things all the way to rape inside facilities, or staff and youth making arrangements to meet in the facility or out of the facility to engage in sexual conduct, and you know that youth aren't really able to consent to that kind of behavior with an adult, especially in a circumstance where that adult has that kind of power over a youth. So those are incidents of sexual abuse as well. And I want to also just point to a number of things in addition to the ones that Linda mentioned that I think are also important parts of the standards. There are a number of protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender kids that are important, including that there's no particular place where those kids should be housed. That there needs to be an individualized determination. There have been facilities around the country that have said, oh, we're going to place them all in the sex offender area, or we're going to make every transgender child be housed with their biological sex. And those really are not the safest ways to treat those kids, and we need to have individualized determinations that include lots of information from them about the circumstances under which they feel most comfortable, as well as a lot of analysis of the circumstances of the facility to find the most appropriate place. We've also seen places that have searched transgender individuals to find out what their genital status is, and there's a specific ban on that in the standards. Another piece of the standards that, you know, a lot of folks who work in juvenile facilities recognize is that having adequate staffing is really important to keeping everyone safe. Having enough staff around to be able to not just see what everybody's up to, but engage with kids in positive ways that can identify if there are problems brewing so that they can prevent them, that also lead to, you know, interactions that are more positive and skill-building interactions rather than don't do this and don't do that. And so the PREA standards actually establish a presumption of the appropriate minimum level of staffing, which is 1 to 8 during waking hours and 1 to 16 at night. But they're also the only provision in the standards that's not finalized. So when the Justice Department issued the standards last summer, they asked for additional public comment about this one component, about what kinds of facilities there should be a staffing standard in the world of juvenile justice, whether it was appropriate to have a standard, whether that particular number was the right ratio. And so the initial standards made that piece of them binding as of 2017, as opposed to the rest of the standards that are come into effect in 2013. But there's also a possibility that the Justice Department will refine that one provision. Regardless, this question of adequate staffing is a really key component. And another one is isolation. So we see in facilities across the country a reliance on isolating kids when people haven't been creative enough about finding ways to keep them safe. And these standards say that isolation can only be as a last resort and provide some specific protections to kids if they are isolated, things like daily exercise and education and daily visits by medical or mental health professionals and a regular review of whether isolation is really the only way to keep them safe in a facility. And then another area that Linda and I have been doing some work on and we think is really exciting is that there's an important part of the standards that's about needing to provide victims of sexual misconduct in facilities with a victim advocate. And that's supposed to come from an outside organization unless they've tried and tried and tried and can't find an outside organization that can provide those services. And so what that means is that in jurisdictions around the country, there are juvenile justice systems reaching out and finding ways to partner with rape crisis centers and other nonprofits who specialize in those sorts of services. And it's opening up a door to some communication, to some cross-learning, to connecting kids with those providers, not just for if they get victimized in a facility, but also for the longer term if they've been victims of abuse before. And so we're really excited to see where that particular provision takes people.
Mm-hmm. So let's just maybe turn for a minute for our youth in adult facilities. Are the protections the same as the ones you've just talked about, or are they different?
No, they're different. So as I mentioned, youth in adult facilities, unless the whole facility is a facility for adult charged youth and it's being run by the juvenile justice system, then those facilities are still subject to the adult jail and prison standards. But within those standards, there are some special protections for kids. So I mentioned in the beginning when we were talking about this that the commission recognized that the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act's rules about sight and sound separation of kids and adults don't apply to kids who are charged in the adult system. And what the PREA standards did was take a big step toward protecting those adult charged kids who are housed in adult facilities. And the rules say that there can be no contact between youth and adult inmates in housing units. So youth and adults can't be housed in the same unit. There can't be adults coming through to clean the units or to be messengers or anything like that. And then in common areas, like programming areas, there can't be contact between youth and adults unless there's constant and direct supervision by staff. And then there's this isolation piece. And the trouble that we see is that in small jails that are trying to do the right thing by keeping youth separated from adults, what they frequently end up doing is isolating those kids. And so the standards also say that those facilities need to make best efforts to avoid isolation as the means to achieve separation, and that if they do have to rely on isolation, that exercise and special education and things like that and other work opportunities need to be provided. So those are very important protections.
We have a question that you talked about. You know, now youth need to be linked with a victim advocate. If they experience sexual violence, who else needs to be told if there is an incident?
Some of that does depend on, obviously, the jurisdiction of the state, but the standards are very clear that any allegation needs to be investigated. And in most cases, that would be both whatever administrator or supervisor is in charge at the time of the incident. It would also be, local law enforcement in most cases for youth facilities. There are some facilities where they may have a certified police officer who's able to do a criminal investigation on site, but that's much more rare in youth facilities than, say, for example, in adults. So local law enforcement, and then, of course, whatever the child abuse reporting mechanism in the area is that all appropriate reports of child abuse would have to be made as a mandated report, just like they would in any other instance of child abuse.
And then there's also some special notification provisions around telling parents and legal guardians, telling the child's attorney, if they have a child welfare caseworker, that person needs to be informed. And that's a big step because there are a lot of special incidents that family members don't find out about unless, you know, their kid gets sent to the hospital and then somebody may notify them. And that varies from facility to facility and jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but this provides an umbrella protection to make sure they're always notified.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to hear from sort of both of you, what do you find some of the most exciting things about the standards and what also do you think are some of the most challenging things, especially for, you know, institutions and communities looking to implement them?
Well, as Dana mentioned, one of the provisions I think that we're both really excited about because of all the implications behind it are the emphasis in the standards on the requirement, the right for a youth who's been abused to have an outside victim advocate and for facilities to work with their local, say, rape crisis centers. And part this is so exciting because, first off, it's a real change. This is a huge change that gives youth the potential, the youth who are incarcerated, the potential to have the same quality of care as youth in the community can have, that there are most youth facilities have medical and mental health staff, but there's no guarantee that those people have received any training specific to sexual abuse in detention. There's no guarantee that they have real expertise in treating this kind of trauma. And so rape crisis centers have existed in the community for decades and provided these kinds of services. It's what they do. And so not only can the youth and then their families can also, usually most rape crisis programs, child abuse service programs provide support to family members and loved ones as well. So family members, parents can get some assistance in understanding what's happened to their child and helping their child to deal with it, learning skills to help their child, especially while they're still inside and when they get out. But the other piece is that what we have experienced in working together across collaborations with corrections, with rape crisis programs, with advocacy groups like JDI and CCLP, is that when these different organizations that have different philosophies and perspectives work together, get to know each other, understand each other's area of expertise and goals and perspectives on this issue, the culture of the facilities really changes. And it becomes much more possible to put into place truly trauma-informed, survivor-centered programs that take into account the needs of an adolescent rape survivor. And so to me, this is really one of the areas where the standards have the potential to help well-meaning people who are going to work, you know, to the intent, the meaning behind that, to really put into place long-lasting change that can make the difference in a lot of youth and families' lives.
And I guess I have a few things to add. I mentioned, and so did Linda, a number of the exciting provisions already, but one that I hadn't talked about is that third parties need to have access to grievance system inside facilities. So frequently it's been the case that a youth would be the only person who was allowed to write a written complaint about something happening to them. And we know that youth who are in many juvenile justice facilities may have poor reading and writing skills, may be afraid of retaliation if they complain about something. And the standards give a requirement that third parties like family members and attorneys need to be able to have access and file complaints on behalf of kids. And that's really asking jurisdictions to think about their grievance systems in a different way and provide a different level of access to those systems. So we think that that's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think just in terms of the broad nature of the standards, there are a lot of details that we can't cover today, but each one of those leads to a discussion about the practices inside a facility.
Mm-hmm.
So in the jurisdictions where we're working on helping them implement, you know, the simplest things like the fact that you need to make sure that you accommodate limited English proficient youth and youth with disabilities so that they have comparable opportunities to access the resources and understand the trainings and be able to report something and be able to talk to an investigator. And so that prompts a lot of questions that go beyond just can they report sexual misconduct to how are we handling limited English proficient youth? Does everybody know how to access a translator? Under what circumstances does a youth get a translator? And same for what kinds of accommodations are we making? Do we even understand what the disabilities are and have the average staff people been attuned to how to interact with kids with particular disabilities? And so the PREA requirements lead to a lot more improvements in basic facility management and working with kids, which we think is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Among the challenges, I would say one of the biggest ones is around the ban on cross-gender PAT searches of kids except in exigent circumstances. So it's actually become the nature of a lot of juvenile facilities that they have a majority of females who work in the facilities and a majority of male kids who are housed in the facilities. And finding enough men to be on every shift so that they can accomplish searches when they need to is actually something of a challenge. And so it's sort of a new opportunity for agencies to look at their recruiting and their hiring and their assignment of people to certain posts. And so we see a lot of discussion and challenge around that. Another interesting one that has led to a lot of conversations in systems is about volunteers. So there are requirements in these standards that volunteers be trained before, in some basic level of understanding about the agency's zero tolerance policy and how to report if there's been a problem or if they suspect that there's a problem of a sexual misconduct nature. And that sounds simple enough, but the mechanisms for delivering that training without deterring volunteer organizations from coming into the facility actually turns out to be something that folks need to think a lot about. We want to encourage them to make connections with as many community organizations as can serve kids, because that, you know, leads to a lot of creativity in programming. It leads kids to develop connections with providers in their communities, and all that's great. And if you require that everybody goes through some amount of training, then that can be an impediment to bringing in volunteers on a really regular basis. And so helping them find ways of doing simple trainings that are maybe, you know, a brief conversation followed by something that they review on paper that doesn't take too long is really important, because everybody's got to know they can't sexually abuse a kid that they come to volunteer and help. On the other hand, we want to strike the right balance.
Mm-hmm. Do you have other considerations that you want to share for agencies and states working to implement the standards, things that you've seen happening so far? I mean, you also mentioned partnerships with local rape crisis centers and state coalitions, maybe other ideas of interesting creative partnerships that institutions and states should be thinking about.
Well, I mean, I think one of the other standards areas that's both a real opportunity and a challenge is the requirement for ongoing medical and mental health care for both sexual abuse victims and abusers. And I think that depending, you know, and this is also another area for collaboration, depending on the size of the facility and what medical and mental health programs they already have in place, many don't provide kind of ongoing mental health care, particularly for people who have been traumatized, specifically for the rape trauma syndrome or post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis. Depending on the field, depending on the facility, sometimes those aren't one of the sort of billable diagnoses, if you will. And certainly for abusers, I think that it's another area where creativity is going to be needed to figure out, if you don't have a sex offender treatment unit, how are you going to provide treatment and care for both parties, also making sure they're separate, and making sure you're addressing all the needs of especially if it's another adolescent, and obviously I'm talking about if it's another youth. And so there are, you know, many communities have other kinds besides rape crisis programs of community mental health programs that might be able to assist with developing those programs and figuring out if there's a contract relationship or some other way. But I think another piece that, again, goes to providing youth the same kind of rights and care as they would in the community is the notification to youth of the outcome of investigations that's in the standards. So in other words, a victim of a crime in the community has the right to be notified when the case is progressing. And that's not something that people who are in custody had the right to before. And that is going to be different for a lot of facilities because of their concerns about confidentiality, their concerns about putting others in danger if information gets out there. But then on the flip side of that, that really opens up an opportunity to work with county district attorney's offices that very often have victim services units within them that work on those kinds of notifications. And so I think the prosecutors, as a really key part of the whole response to sexual violence in the community, that, you know, there are places also within the standards that encourage collaborations there as well.
Another area that is a really exciting opportunity for collaboration that we've seen systems really embrace is in the question of investigation. So if a child is abused inside of a facility, there are three different entities that could potentially be doing investigations. There's Child Protective Services, there's whatever the criminal law enforcement investigation entity is, and then there's the internal investigating body of the agency. And so all three of them have legitimate needs and interests in evidence protection and, you know, getting a good interview from the victim and from other witnesses, and they really do need to coordinate, and that coordination doesn't happen best at the time of a serious incident. It really happens best beforehand. And so we're seeing agencies be really creative and proactive and thoughtful about coming together and bringing those other entities together to think about what's the plan going to be ahead of time. And so it's a great opportunity to collaborate with agencies that they work with but don't get to plan with as regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly, these standards are long overdue, and congratulations to both of you. I know you worked hard to make this happen, and they're also really comprehensive and complex, and maybe even the year down the road, we should really revisit this to see, you know, how institutions and communities are managing their implementation. Just so our listeners know, Linda and Dana submitted many resources and links to agencies that you may want to look at for more information, and those are all posted on the show site on Children's Law Center's website. But just to mention a few here, so Just Detention International, they're justdetention.org. The Center for Children's Law and Policy is cclp.org. And there is a PREA National Resource Center, and that's PREAResourceCenter.org. So final thoughts.
Well, one of the things I just want to mention, we don't have time to get into the details, but there are leading jurisdictions that have really stepped up to the plate and said, we think this is deeply important to our core values and to making sure that we really fulfill our, not just our constitutional responsibility, but our moral responsibility to keep kids safe when they're in our care. And we think it's wonderful that that administrators around the country are starting to take really thoughtful looks at doing careful implementation of these standards. And we really commend them, and we're excited about the partnerships that we have with them to do that work. And we're looking forward to seeing that continue as there are more good models and more resources for people to reach out to their peers and to the, you know, the resource centers that are popping up to support people.
And there's, you know, there's a lot of challenges in implementing the standards, as we've talked about, and I think that, you know, both Dana and I would agree that there they're not perfect, but they really are a once in, it feels like a once in a lifetime opportunity to put into place programs, policies, practice, and almost more philosophy that will make facilities safer for youth, that will provide opportunities to provide care for youth who have been abused, and can really have a chance to transform juvenile corrections. It's really, again, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. At least that's how it feels.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being on the show today. Our next show will focus on family engagement in correctional settings, and guests will be from the Vera Institute of Justice and the Ohio Department of Youth Services. They're going to discuss their efforts to keep families connected while youth are incarcerated and integrate a strength-based approach into the parole framework. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Again, Linda, Dana, thank you so much, and thank you for your continued work on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.